Welcome to BIO, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. BIO is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm BIO member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we'll talk with a biographer about his or her work. This time, veteran journalist, historian, and author Mark Leibson talks about his latest biography, The Unlikely War Hero, a Vietnam War POW's story of courage and resilience in the Hanoi Hilton. It was published by Stackpole Press in December 2024. Mark Leibson was interviewed by fellow biographer and BIO member John, better known as Jack Farrell.
Mark, how are you?
I'm okay for an older type individual.
I know the feeling. Okay, so tell us about the new book. I think this is your 11th book. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. And four of them have been biographies. This book is called The Unlikely War Hero, and it's a slice of life biography of the youngest and lowest ranking American captured in North Vietnam during the Vietnam War and held at the infamous Hanoi Hilton in Hanoi. It's the story of a young guy, a 20-year-old kid named Doug Hegdahl, who was a Navy seaman apprentice. So that he was an E-2. He was the second lowest rank in the Navy. He was on a ship, a guided missile cruiser in the Tonkin Gulf, and he'd only been on there for 2 months. This was in early April of 67. And because he heard the guys say how cool it was to see these big guns firing. The Canberra was the name of the ship. It was a guided missile. They never fired a guided missile in anger during the Vietnam War, but they had these big guns, 5 and 8 inch guns that could, you know, hit targets 3 miles away. So they were offshore in the South China Sea. And he went on deck at 4 o'clock in the morning. And the next thing he knew, he says he was in the drink. He doesn't remember what happened. No one saw it. So there's kind of a mystery right at the heart of the whole story. But he did survive about 3 hours in the water. He thought he was going to sink. And then he saw a fishing boat and they picked him up, took him to land, and then they shipped him to the Hanoi Hilton. So Doug says that he was the only POW in the Hanoi Hilton who was not captured. He was rescued.
Well, you know, I was puzzled too until I saw the photos in the book. And that's a very narrow deck. I mean, those guns take up a huge part of the deck. But that seems to be a mystery that you sort of explored. What did you think were the other possibilities?
Well, you've heard the word scuttlebutt. Now, I was in the Army. I learned an awful lot about the Navy from naval historians and friends who served in the Navy during the Vietnam War. And I have a feeling that being on a ship adds to the intensity and the craziness of scuttlebutt. So no one saw it. Doug says he doesn't remember. So like you said, it was a narrow deck, and it was a teak wood deck up there by those guns. So it could have been really slippery. The guns could have gone, and then the ship may have turned, and he went over. I talked to like 21 sailors who were on that ship during its Vietnam War cruises. They did five of them. About, I think, 8 or 10 were on that ship. And people told me they think that he got into a fight and someone kicked him overboard, or that he wanted to end it all and he jumped. And then he had second thoughts and tried to stay alive. Then the most outlandish one is that he was a spy recruited by the CIA, jump overboard on purpose, and then, you know, whatever.
Gerald Ford almost fell off an aircraft carrier, and he was only saved by, I think, the netting that was on some sort of grid that was at the edge of the deck. So I guess it's not that hard a thing.
Serving on ship is dangerous, and even more dangerous in the war. I think the figure is there were 257 sailors who went overboard from ships during the Vietnam War, which is not a small number. And, you know, a lot of them were under fire or a fire. You know, there were fires on ships. So it's a dangerous job serving on a ship, much less when there's a war.
Yep.
So Doug testified before Congress. He was also officially debriefed, and they, of course, asked what happened. So under oath to Congress and, you know, with his Marine debriefer after he came home, he said he didn't remember. And the debriefer posited that, and I've talked to people who, you know, of course, no one knows, or at least if someone saw it, they'd never step forward. And I've talked to people who knew him well, knew the ship, And they kind of agreed that he probably fell off, knocked by the concussion of the guns firing.
What was interesting was with your ace investigative reporter talents, you also found that they recorded him as present and able at the next time they all gathered for president accounted for, right?
Yeah, at the first muster in the next
First muster.
morning, I was really lucky because the ship's logs are now all online from the National Archives. So you can read the handwritten logs minute by minute by what happened. I mean, I was shocked when I read that first muster. And that also led to some people speculating after the fact that there was malfeasance. I believe that they messed up when they reported all hands accounted for. I don't believe that they purposely did anything to cover anything up, but it led people to believe that something happened because the next muster he was reported missing and they searched and searched and couldn't find him.
So what draws you to this particular story? Because there's part two of the story is what happens when he's in captivity.
Yeah. Well, this story's been out there. In fact, I've known about it for at least 25 years. And it intrigued me from the, a 20-year-old kid. He has this amazing memory. He memorized all these names. He came home and he gave 254 names, and 64 people were immediately changed from missing in action to prisoner of war. In other words, their families knew they were alive.
So one thing that you found important and heroic was that as a prisoner of war, he was able to memorize the names of the other prisoners so that when he got home, he was able to reassure a lot of the family.
That's correct. So that story was out there and I knew about it and I had finished the book and I was looking around for it. I thought this has to be my next book. So I managed to get a hold of Doug. I talked to him on the phone. He was cooperative. And then basically he wasn't. The next time I contacted him, he said he was a private person and this was in like 01 and didn't want to talk. And in fact, he barely has spoken in public in those 24 years since then. And then I finished my previous book, which was The Ballad of the Green Beret, the biography of Barry Sadler, who wrote the famous song. And you know the process. I was looking around and I thought, I'm going to give it one more try. And during the pandemic, it was 2020, and so I spent an awful lot of time writing a proposal. My agent was great. She helped me shape it. And we got the book. And Doug's story's out there. You should Google him. He's there. But you know what happens when you Google somebody? Some stuff is true. But then there's always something that's not right. So I wanted to really write for the record and get as much fact in there. And that's another reason that I wrote the book.
Well, it's also a very small D democratic thing to do because we hear about John McCain and the other leading, more glamorous POWs. And certainly Doug was all the way at the bottom of the barrel in terms of rank and age. I found it very interesting to see how just your normal swabby gets through the day. I thought that one story, you portray him as brushing leaves or raking leaves, and the POWs needed to know where the prison was located. And so while he was brushing the leaves, he just kept walking out the gate, brushing leaves, and he could come back and tell them what the intersection of the next street was. That was a wonderful anecdote in there.
Yeah, the reason he was out there raking leaves was that he buffaloed the North Vietnamese by pretending to be dumb. Nobody taught him to do that. I mean, he was just a 20-year-old kid who finds himself, like you said, there he is among the John McCains and Jeremiah Dentons and all these high-flying older guys. And here is this kid who'd never been outside the United States before, graduated from high school at 19, he had to do one extra year, et cetera. He figured it out somehow. And these interrogators were not Boy Scouts, okay? The first thing they did when they got somebody in there, they wanted to pump them for all the information they could get. And actually they did think he was a spy at first. They couldn't believe a kid would fall off a ship and then be in the South China Sea for at least 3 hours. Those logs I told you about, I know when the guns were firing and when they stopped. So it's pretty clear when he went in, and then it was just after sunrise. So he's a big, strong kid. I mean, he wrestled heavyweight in high school, but still he was about to sink. So when he got there, first of all, he did convince them that he had no knowledge that they could use. He spent most of the time beneath deck. He was an E2. He had no airplane information to give him, no bombing information. And so they did believe that eventually. And then he just started acting like the village idiot. they would say, and you know, where are you from, or what's the nearby town? And he'd ask him to spell city or something like that. He would take the ink pen and put it in his mouth and let the ink dribble down his chin. And one guard called him the incredibly stupid one. And he was never tortured, right to the brink of, you know, when they, in the beginning, they made him, you know, like get down on his knees with rice underneath in it, but he was never really brutalized. They kind of left him alone. And so that's how he was able to get out there. And he did find the address to the Hanoi Hilton. You know, you heard about the tap code, right? Where the prisoners developed this kind of Morse-like code. When he got there, prisoners were not allowed to talk to each other or communicate in any way upon the pain of torture. So they developed a tap code between their cells where they would tap letter by letter and communicate. And they also had an adjunct to that, which was a sweep code. So when Doug was out there sweeping, guys could peer through the little bars on their cells and he could tell them, you know, there's Commander McCain is in New Guy Village and da da da, and this and that. So he was doing that too. And the North Vietnamese didn't have a clue.
But at one point, he goes on a hunger strike, and the photo is particularly gripping there. He's terribly gaunt. So it wasn't that he was
Right.
unprincipled or docile.
No, he wasn't. And that was kind of out of character because a prisoner at an adjoining cell, they got him for talking, for communicating, and they tortured him. And Doug went out of character for probably the only time he was there and, you know, made it, what the hell are you doing? Why did you? So they slapped him in solitary for 9 months. And he decided to go on a hunger strike. And those pictures you see in the book that you just mentioned, you know, he was a big strapping guy, probably weighed 220. Maybe not when he was in Hanoi, but he was at least 200 and he looked like he lost 40 or 50 pounds. And that actually worked and got him out of solitary because they didn't have any use for him anyway, but much less use for a guy who looked like a walking skeleton.
So there were several early releases, which in themselves were controversial because many of the guys who stayed behind thought that the POWs who agreed to go home should have refused. But because Doug had this knowledge in his head, he was actually submitted, prompted, pushed forward to the front of the line. Or how did that work that the Vietnamese picked this guy who knew so much?
12 Americans were released early from the Hanoi Hilton. 11 of them signed admissions of guilt to being war criminals. They were all flyers. Doug is the exception. Number one, the North Vietnamese wanted him out of there. So Doug was in with a guy named Dick Stratton, who was like in his mid to late 30s. He was a pilot. He got shot down. And for some reason, no rhyme or reason, actually, they were always moving guys around into cells. In 64, 65, 66. So one day Stratton's in the cell and they throw Doug in there and they looked at each other and there was this kid from Clark, South Dakota, and Dick Stratton, who had an MA from Stanford and been in the Navy fighter jock, et cetera. Anyway, they bonded. And by the way, he died in January, but over the 2 years that I wrote the book, I interviewed him probably, I don't know, 30 or 40. Now he was, couldn't hear. So we did it all via email, but he would answer my emails morning, noon, or night with paragraphs of questions that I had. So he was a gold mine for me. And he'd also written about it, and the story's out there. But Dick discovered that Doug had this great memory. And so Doug wasn't the only one memorizing names. Others did too, because they didn't want to happen what happened during the Korean War when hundreds, if not God knows how many guys perished and nobody had any record of them. So they all thought that when they came home eventually, they could let the Pentagon and the families know who they knew for sure was there. Now, we had intel. The US had intel. Plus, the North Vietnamese, they were proud that they captured John McCain. You know, as soon as they did, then his father was the chief of naval forces in the Pacific. They put out press releases and for a few other guys. And they allowed friendly press in there from communist countries and like friendly communist newspaper reporters from Japan and other non-communist countries. And they would have Potemkin villages and they bring in prisoners and make it look like they were feeding them well. Anyway, so we had intel. So once Doug had memorized a whole bunch of names, Stratton gave him a direct order. So the POWs had a de facto chain of command behind bars. You know how the military is, they organize. So Dick was the highest ranking officer in his section of the Hanoi Hilton. He went to the highest ranking officer. And when I say went, you know, we're talking about the tap code here. Got him communicate. I got this kid. He knows all these names. So Dick ordered him to go, but Doug refused because of what you said earlier. The other POWs despised the guys who went home because, you know, they were disloyal in their eyes. They had to sign a paper, you know, admitting they were war criminals. And then, you know, I've read a lot of oral histories of POWs. And when they're asked about the early returnees, they have mixed reactions, ranging to these guys were traitors and should be hung, to, oh, you know, these guys maybe did what they had, but most of them hated them. And then they always would say, but no, not Doug, not Doug. 11 of them are traitors. But Doug was ordered to go home because he had this intel. So after he refused, you know, he got moved around again a few times. Then he spoke up out of character. So this is, don't forget, he was captured in April of 67. And I think he went into solitary in fall of 68, something like that. And he got out in early 69. And then everybody knew, including Doug, that the Vietnamese, they were trying to recruit POWs to go home early if they would, you know, sign this paper. And if they asked him again, he was going to go. So that's what happened. And he did.
So, Mark, this spring is the 50th anniversary of the fall of Saigon. You are a journalist, a book writer. You're somebody who's worked for a long time with the Vietnam Veterans of America. Where does Vietnam fit in our national psyche and memory now?
I've worked for Vietnam Veterans of America since 1986. I still am the senior writer for our magazine. And I write a lot about the war and even more about veterans like myself. And you want to think that as far as policy, that we learned a lesson in the Vietnam War. You want to think that because of the terrible outcome for us and for Vietnamese and that we were fighting with. But, you know, I'm not sure that we have. We haven't gone to war with an army like we did in the Vietnam War. You know, when I was over there in 68, we had 550,000 boots on the ground in country. And those 2 years, 68, 69, we were losing casualties were like 400 a week killed and wounded and taken prisoner. Nothing like that's happened. But as far as our military adventures overseas, you know, I'm not sure we've learned any lessons whatsoever, except maybe not to get involved in a gigantic outpouring of American troops. And as far as Vietnam War veterans are concerned, you know, we're the old ones now. And I think we were treated abysmally when we got home. The country was terribly divided between hawks and doves. And doves, anti-war people, blamed us, the men and women who served there, for the horror of that war and for even taking part in it. And hawks, you know, are sort of our parents' generation, the World War II generation, the so-called greatest generation, they turned their backs on us because they called us losers, you know, as if the individual troops were responsible for this debacle. And the other thing is, people might not know this about the rotation system. So we were 2.8 million who served in country. We went over there by ourselves on chartered commercial jets. In the beginning, they put boats loads of units, but that ended pretty quickly. And so when we had a 1 year tour of duty and you got to come home, you know, when that was over. So we went over by ourselves and came back by ourselves. And that didn't do anything to help. And in every war, no matter whether you win or lose, everybody who takes part in it, when they come back home, has post-traumatic stress issues. You wouldn't be normal if you didn't, if you didn't come from a war zone. And here us, we flew in jets. 18 hours later, we were in the U.S. A psychiatrist told me once he treated a guy who woke up in his childhood bedroom in Kansas with the dirt from Vietnam under his fingernails. And then you come home to this climate of the country divided, blaming you for the war. And, you know, the traditional veteran service organizations dominated by World War II veterans turned their backs on us, didn't want to have anything to do with us. And so we stopped talking. We knew nobody wanted to talk about it. So we stopped, which is never good. So things started to change in 1981 when the hostages from Iran came home and the country went nuts with ticker tape parades and free tickets to Major League Ball. And people looked around and said, wait a minute, 3 million men and women who served in Vietnam and we're still treating them like shit. I'm sorry, but that's the word. And so consciousnesses got raised And then came the dedication of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in November 1982. And we had our welcome home parade. And, you know, we called it blaming the warrior for the war. And that began to end right then. And by the way, Jack, let me just tell you, the title of the book is The Unlikely War Hero. I do not use the word hero lightly. I'm no hero. I mean, people now, you know, oh, you're our hero. You took part in this war. I didn't do anything heroic. I did what I had to do. I went over there. I came home. So I don't like the way that word is used that loosely. But what Doug did, I'm calling it one of the most, if not the most heroic acts by somebody who served in the Vietnam War, not in combat, to face up to these hardened interrogators who tortured and killed guys for doing what he did and for figuring that out and then for buffaloing them and then bringing home these names. And then when he did, like I said, 66, I think it was 66 families learned that their father's husband's, you know, sons were alive. If you are missing an action in the Vietnam War, it's pretty much that you were gone, especially for flyers. So I use the word hero very advisedly here, and I do believe Doug was a hero.
Okay, so for young biographers or young authors, you have written this interesting array of books. You did a terrific book, my favorite of the books of yours that I've read, Saving Monticello, about the family that takes over Thomas Jefferson's house. And I was just down in Monticello not too long ago, still on sale in the bookstore there.
Thank you.
You've written biographies of Francis Scott Key and Lafayette and Barry Sadler. And this really nice book about a battle that nobody knows anything about, but actually turned out to be very interesting, the Battle of Monocacy in the Civil War. What is your divining rod that brings you to a project? You know, why Doug and not John McCain or a combat hero, or why Monocacy rather than a book about Gettysburg? You know, what is it that takes you to that page?
Yeah, well, good question. I've specialized in U.S. history, and I'm looking for a story, and preferably, like you said, well, you talked about the Battle of Monocacy, July 9th, 1864, outside of Frederick, Maryland. Not many people heard of it, but it's called the battle that saved Washington, D.C., because this was the first time that a corps of troops was sent from the South to attack Washington. And they were on the way when they were held up, you know, 35 miles away at Monocacy by an undermanned Union force, which gave Grant time to get troops up from Richmond and Petersburg. So I was intrigued by that story. And, you know, Francis Scott Key, I had written a book called Flag and American Biography, which is a history of the American flag. And when I was writing it, when I got to write about the Star Spangled Banner, I couldn't find a current biography. The latest one was 1937. I wrote that book in 02, 03. And after the Lafayette book came out in 2011, I was talking to my agent, we were looking at 2014. And I first thought about World War One, you know, but there's so many great books that have been written about 1914. And then I thought, well, what about 1814? So my biography, which came out in 2014 of Francis Scott Key, was the first one since 1937. And I found a lot of information that wasn't in the previous one, which is also pretty hagiographic too. One thing, they called him Frank. So if there's one thing you can remember from this interview, his friends called him Frank.
If 1937 was the last time that the biography was written, your take on his status as a slaveholder would be entirely different in 2014. It's always a fascinating process to me how current events affect an author's interpretation of a life that was 200 years ago.
Yeah, no, you're 100% right. And the issue of slavery was a big part of his life for his whole career. You know, he was a big lawyer and he also had enslaved people. You know, he lived in Washington, but they had a big place out near Frederick, Maryland. And his grandfather's enslaved 200 people in Southern Maryland. You know, Maryland was a slave owning state. So he was a figure in the early Republic. He never held public office, but he was in Andrew Jackson's kitchen cabinet. He was a big DC lawyer, prosecutor. And a lot of his career centered around the issue of slavery, including the American Colonization Society. He was a founding member of it. You know, that was the movement to send free blacks, not enslaved people, but free blacks to Africa, not even back to Africa. You know, I mean, people were born here. Very controversial, but he was a strong believer in it from the time they founded it in 1818 to the day he died in the 1840s. So, yeah, you're absolutely right about that.
So speak to those young authors about somebody who has made a living with a pen, and in the age of podcasts and AI, how do you exist as a writer, Mark?
First thing, don't quit your day job. You know, Jack, very few of us make our living through our writing. I mean, it's the way it is. No, yeah, no, I'm very lucky that I worked at Congressional Quarterly for 11 and a half years, and I quit in 1986 to go freelance. And the next year I had a steady gig at the Veteran Magazine at VV, at Vietnam Veterans of America. So I have stayed there. My work has increased for them. I have an office there and a phone and email and everything. So with that steady paycheck, I've been able to write books. But if you have the fire in you, you're going to do it. If you want to do it, regardless of your financial situation, yes, it's good to have a day job, but just get out there and do it. And that's my advice.
Well, as a very young reporter way back in the 90s, I was at a political event, and there was Norman Mailer. And I just signed my first book contract, or just submitted my first proposal. And I went up to him. I said, "Hey, Mr. Mailer, I'm about to join you on the ranks of American authors." And I said, "Do you have any advice for me?" And he said, "Yeah, get a good agent, kid," and walked away.
I was going to say, I thought you were going to say punched you in the face or something.
Along the lines of don't quit your day job. When you go to sleep at night, through the subjects of your biographies that you're working on or after they've been published, do they come and visit your dreams?
I'm going to say not my dreams, but my subconscious. It's happened more than a few times where the term shower thoughts, stuff like that. You don't even think you're thinking about it, right? And then you get to your desk, or I've had them in the middle of the night. What I do is I email myself. And what we do when we immerse ourselves in these subjects, I think that we can't help but have it be in there, be in our brain at all times, whether we're th consciously thinking about it or not. And so you're coming to the end of the book. And you're thinking about the big picture and how to wrap it up. And somehow it's like alchemy, it sort of comes to you. So that's a great question. And I don't think I'm alone. I know I'm not alone. I think a version of that has to happen to anybody because anybody who's written the book knows you're writing 7 days a week, researching, writing 7 days a week for months and months, if not years on end. So it's part of your fiber and your being. And it's there.
Thanks very much, Mark.
Jack, thanks, man. You were great.
That was historian and author Mark Leibson speaking with John Farrell about his latest book, The Unlikely War Hero, a Vietnam War POW's story of courage and resilience in the Hanoi Hilton. It was published by Stackpole Press in December 2024. And this interview was recorded via Zoom on April 11th of this year.